So the Earth's gravity isn't constant across the surface, and there's many things which feed into it, some of which are quite large effects, like the position of the moon and the tides and other things. But if you strip all that away, you can still measure very precisely variations in the gravitational field locally that are effectively caused by small variations in the amount of mass in the subsurface.
Stick with us and we'll guide you through the world of geophysics.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple-story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Joining me today on the Breaking Ground podcast is George Tuckwell, director at RSK. He's the director of geosciences and engineering, and also Richard Pidcock, the MD at Central Alliance. Hello to you both, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Thanks for inviting us on.
Absolute pleasure. Of course, RSK and Central Alliance, they are joined. George, can you explain, because the RSK group have gone through a real period of growth over the last few years. Do you and Richard know each other?
So RSK is an interesting structure, I think, in that sense. We're a group of businesses, but we're a group of businesses that can work closely together. And so I know Richard well. We've worked together on particularly interesting technologies like the ones that we're going to discuss today. But there's a lot of areas of collaboration between businesses when we're providing solutions to our clients.
So. Oh, great. And I know the power testing company, NDT Services, and I don't know how they brand. I think they're still called NDT Services, but
they're still called NDT Services. It's one of the unique aspects of RSK as a group of companies is each business maintains its own identity. Usually that's the most common model. So NDT are one example of those. They're still very active under their own brand. So I'm very pleased you know of them.
Yes, great guys there, and worked with them for many years. And for the former owners there, it was a great opportunity to release some money before retirement, but for their business as well to move forward and grow. I think I can see that's been really positive for the company as well. So good to hear more about the work of RSK, and I'm sure there'll be more acquisitions coming in future years. But we're here really to talk about geophysics and the range of techniques. So I mentioned in one previous podcast that this was coming up, and we touched on a unique aspect, which was the use of airborne geophysics techniques. But I want to take a step back and just really cover all of the range of techniques and give the listeners a taste for their applications and how each technique works, because I think most listeners like me really will maybe be a bit naive to what's out there, probably, for those that have worked mainly in the piling sector, for instance, will have been more used to conventional ground investigation techniques. And I know that this sort of technology is evolving all the time, so it'd be good to bring us up to date as well. One of the things that I discovered was the term quantum technology, and that there's a lot of funding being made available from government at the moment for that. George, I think you have been working with government to access funding and develop techniques. And first of all, could you sort of define what quantum technology is? Is it just a sort of a group of technologies, of which geophysics is one. I couldn't really find a decent definition of the term.
Yeah, so the broad definition of the term in terms of the government initiative to fund the development of technologies is any technology which relies on quantum effects to work. And so if a subset of that is the sensor technologies, which then feed into the geophysics space. So geophysics using conventional technologies is a broad range of tools we can use to map various physical properties in the subsurface that we use to map the ground, to understand what's there and to de-risk it. What quantum technology in that context then provides is perhaps some new ways to measure those physical parameters more accurately and or more quickly. And that's where it gives us the advantage. So the fact that it's quantum doesn't mean anything other than perhaps it gives us the opportunity to have better instruments in the future.
Okay. But quantum, the inference is that it's all atoms and molecules and really nano forms of technology. The funding itself that the government's making available is quite interesting, because I recently recorded an episode with, it hasn't been released yet, so you won't be aware of the suggestion, but there was a lack of funding for university research projects from the government. And it's interesting that from the article that I read that there seemed to be money being made available for this sort of technology. But is that more going into the private sector than into universities currently?
No, I think it's going into both. I think the quantum technology is a particular theme that has attracted funding from government for a number of years. It started, I guess, 6 or 7 years ago with the funding of the university hubs. So the first real tranche of funding in this area went to groups of academic departments across multiple universities. And the group that we've particularly been interacting with is the Sensors and Timing Hub, which is led by Birmingham University, but there are a number of other university partners. So that's where the first funding came from. It's been built on subsequently by funding rounds that have also been made available to support industry involvement. Again, very much off the back of that initial work that's been done by the academic departments that formed those hubs. And 4 years ago, the first real tranche of funding from the Industry Strategy Challenge Fund, which had a quantum theme, became available, and RSK led a successful bid for funds there. Again, a good proportion of which went into universities. So I think it's right that it's a challenge to attract funding. And there, of course, there isn't enough to go around, and it's a competitive environment.
Sure.
But there is some funding there for, I guess, these emerging themes particularly, and quantum happens to be one where there is funding available from government currently.
Well, they've clearly identified that as a potential growth area and crucial to the economic development of the country. So yeah, maybe the particular challenges that the university that I was talking to had were reflective, like you say, of that sort of competitive tendering environment for the funding. So let's then talk about the applications. Now there's a really great document that I'm going to try and share with the listeners that you've produced, George. Nice picture of you on the front. A reference for geophysical techniques and applications, which when it comes to preparing for this podcast, I did find that really useful in going through. So page 5, for anybody listening, it's got a nice flowchart. So do you need to have a geophysical type of site investigation? And you've got a yes or a no. And really the reason that you would do geophysical over a standard intrusive investigation is if you're trying to prove the absence of something. For instance, the absence of ground because of old mine workings or because of a solution feature. Solution features seem to keep cropping up in on these recordings, actually. Or if it's an old quarry and you're worried that there might be huge voids in the ground. But then I suppose the next question is, Right, you've identified that geophysics is the way to go, and that it provides perhaps a more comprehensive study into what's missing. But there seems to be, I don't know, 20 different geophysics techniques. So how do we group them? Where do we start? And let's get into the detail of some of the main ones. I don't know that we can cover it all. And Richard, feel free to come in and really sort of extend on what you see as the key ones. But George, maybe you can start us off by just sort of saying how you would group techniques. You know, in my line of work, we've got board piling, we've got driven piling. It's a bit more expansive in terms of geophysics.
Yeah, so I guess there's a number of ways that you could group them, but maybe one of the easier ways is based on perhaps grouping the physical parameters that they're trying to measure, and then you can look at those that way. So there's the potential field methods, and they seek to measure either a magnetic field or a gravitational field. So these are the magnetometers that you might be familiar seeing for archaeological surveys, mapping the shallow subsurface for archaeological remains. But we use them for UXO, we use them for brownfield, we use them for lots of other applications. The gravity techniques, which are the best ones for finding voids and mine shafts and anything which represents an absence of mass in the subsurface. So those are the potential fields.
So gravity techniques, how does that work then?
So the Earth's gravity isn't constant across the surface, and there's many things which feed into it, some of which are quite large effects, like the position of the moon and the tides and other things. But if you strip all that away, you can still measure very precisely variations in the gravitational field locally that are effectively caused by small variations in the amount of mass in the subsurface. So if you have a mine shaft or a solution feature, that represents an absence of mass. So there's less material immediately under where you've made that measurement. And therefore, there's slightly less gravity there as a result. And you can measure those slight differences. And if you do that as a mapping exercise across the surface of a piece of ground, then you get a map which effectively reflects the density variations in the ground. And you can pick up then features like mine shaft solution features, tunnels, basements, and other things.
Okay, so but you get a reflection, do you, of from the ground? You're sending a wave
It's not a reflection in the sense that other geophysical techniques send a signal into the ground and that signal bounces back. The way the potential field instruments work is they're measuring the potential field of, be it gravity or magnetics. So every feature, every bit of mass generates a potential field around it, which is it manifests as a gravitational attraction. And so if you've got slightly more of something or slightly less of something, then you get a variation in that potential field. And that's the thing that we're measuring with those instruments. So they have an advantage over some of the other techniques where you need to send a signal into the ground and get it reflected back, in that they're not relying on something being transmitted, because as we transmit those signals through the ground, they get absorbed. So there's a limitation in the depth that you can see. Whereas with gravity and magnetics, there's no limitation in the depth that you can see. The only limitation is the further away it is, the bigger it needs to be visible.
Okay.
But one of the ways we've mapped the structure of the core of the planet is through the gravitational signal of it. So there's no restriction in the depth range. Obviously, it needs to be a big thing to be visible at that sort of depth, but it's basically the same physics as if you're mapping a 2 meter diameter tunnel 10 meters down.
So is it essentially like an X-ray or?
It isn't quite. It's like mapping the result of things. And so if you imagine you've got a spherical void in the subsurface, as you take measurements, say in a profile across the surface above where that spherical void is, when you're off to one side by quite a long distance, there's been no change in the gravity values that you measure there. But as you get closer and closer to the void, you'll start to see its effect in the measurements. And when you're directly over the top of it, the effect will be at its maximum. And then as you move away off over the other side, it'll go back. So you end up with a sort of an upside down bell curve. centered on the position of the void. Now, if you then imagine you've got a more complicated site with a few things going on, you basically get all these types of signals superimposed on each other. So what you end up with is a map which is represented, it's a map of gravity, and that gravity represents the variation in density. But there's a bit of work to do to go from that gravity map to being an interpretation of what's in the ground. So it's difficult to use that sort of X-ray analogy where you've got a direct image of what's there. You've got a map of the gravity that results from what's there. And so there's one step of kind of calculations and interpretation that you need to do to get from one to the other.
Yeah.
Which is why these technologies can be challenging to understand and interact with, because you need a team of specialists to collect the data well in the first place, but then also to provide that interpretation. Because ultimately the client doesn't particularly care what the gravity is doing. What they want to know is whether their piling foundation solution is going to work because the limestone's full of holes, or whether the pipeline's going to work because there's areas of mining impacted ground that it's got to cross that they need to properly engineer solutions for.
So. Yeah, when I was chatting to the guys from Emerald Geomodeling, they were talking about the use of the technology to try and identify areas where there was either softer ground or hard rock, and their client, which was on this project in Norway, they were trying to find the rock because the rock would be easier to form the tunnel in than in the soft ground. But I did wonder whether there was any other sorts of geophysics technology that could actually go a step further in the soft soils that are common in the UK, and actually identify different levels of types of soil. So trying to say whether you're hitting Thanet sand, for instance, at a certain depth, which for a piling contractor can be really important to see whether your CFA rigs can get into that material. And clearly you get a much better end bearing capacity if you can tow into it. So it can, that extra meter that could make or break the power performance and the cost of the job. So do any of your range of techniques enable us to look at soil types?
Yeah, so the most applicable technique in that circumstance is the seismic technique. And this in very simple terms is you cause a vibration, a seismic wave, to go through the ground, and you listen for when it arrives at various positions at the surface, either along a profile or in an array of geophones that would listen for those signals. And effectively what you can then build up from that data is the speed at which those waves are travelling through different parts of the ground. And it's therefore quite effective for picking up where competent rock is compared with, say, weathered or softer rock, and then the soils and head materials that might sit over the top, because seismically, in terms of how quickly a vibration travels through them, corresponds very well to the competence of the rock. And whilst it's not a direct proxy for the rock strength, it's a pretty good indicator of whether you're in bedrock or whether you're in weathered materials or sufficient deposits. And so, yeah, so building up a picture using those sort of seismic waves is the most common technique applied to that kind of problem.
And it's similar principle whether you're going from a clay to a sand. It's all about the porosity of the material effects, or the density affects how quickly the wave would go through.
Yeah, and it's really the elastic properties.
Right.
So it's the level of cementation, as much as anything else in geological terms. Quite often that goes hand in hand with density, but it isn't density that's the key parameter. The key parameter are the elastic parameters of the soil or of the rock. And so the more elastically stiff the material is, the faster the wave will travel through. So if you're going from a clay into a sandstone, you'll go from a slowish material into a faster material, and you'll be able to see that contrast.
Now, Richard, it must be important to contrast that, because if you're using this sort of technology to identify the difference between a clay and a sand, it's not completely obvious with a unintrusive investigation where one material goes into the next. But if you're supplementing that with conventional, whether it be cable percussion or rotary cord holes, that sort of completes the picture. And I think that's something that you guys do at sort of one-stop shop, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So we'd generally use conventional ground investigation techniques supplemented with geophysics so that we can directly tie the strata into what we're observing and logging in the boreholes to the geophysics. And the advantage of that is we get wider coverage across sites, so we don't need to sink boreholes, you know, multiple boreholes across a wide area. We can use geophysics to supplement that. So yeah, correlation with boreholes is often very useful and key to geophysical techniques.
So is geophysics something that's come fairly recently to Central Alliance, or was that sort of the, forgive the pun, the bedrock of the business?
Yeah, yeah, the core business, I guess, but certainly where the business originated is within ground investigation. But we've expanded on that. George is very much the geophysics expert within RSK and Central Alliance. But we've been working on some new technology that is included in the geophysics realm, I guess. So we're using non-intrusive techniques, one of which, and it comes back to your reference to X-rays, actually, is muon tomography.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure how to pronounce it, to be honest. It was on my list of questions to ask. Yeah. Where's the name come from?
It's it's cosmic ray muons. So cosmic rays are bombarding the Earth constantly. And when these cosmic rays hit the Earth's outer atmosphere, there's reactions and they disperse into subatomic particles, which are known as muons. So it's possible to detect these muons. They keep traveling down to the Earth. And due to the density of the particles, they continue into the Earth. So it's possible to detect these subatomic cosmic ray muons at depth within the Earth. And that's, we've been working with three universities, Sheffield University, Durham and St Mary's originally, and subsequently they spin out from those universities, Geoptic, applying muon tomography to infrastructure and construction applications. So we've been fortunate enough to be supported by clients on a number of proof of concept trials. So specifically with muon tomography, Network Rail have supported us to prove the concept. And to do that, we took a muon detector into an abandoned tunnel. We took regular readings throughout that tunnel. And the purpose being to search for hidden shafts, so hidden construction shafts, which were sunk during the construction of the tunnel in the late 1800s when they were generally constructed. Some of those shafts were retained as air shafts, but a number of others were often either backfilled or the tunnel lining was put in and covered over at the surface and then forgotten about. So it's important to understand where these hidden shafts are and what the infill is, where, you know, what the composition of the infill is. So by the basic principles of muon tomography is that we're counting muons when they hit the detector. So where we've got, for example, if we were to place the detector below an open air shaft, we would see a spike in muon flux where muons are passing through the open air shaft to the detector without being attenuated by the overburden. If we move the detector away from the open air shaft, we're detecting muons that have passed through the overburden above the tunnel and they're attenuated. So essentially we see a drop in muon flux, and it's that principle that we're using to search for these hidden construction shafts.
Okay. I had to check the date for a moment there and make sure I wasn't being pranked. We're close to April Fool's Day. Just sort of the technology, the term seems almost a joke, but clearly the technology is not. So you've got to get your receptors at depth to see how many of these rays are able to penetrate the the ground, and the more that come through, the more...
That's one of the limitations of the system, I guess, is that the detector has got to be placed either below or alongside the subject matter. So what brought this technique to our attention was in 2017, there was a hidden chamber discovered in the Great Pyramid, and that was discovered using muon tomography techniques. So similar to other techniques, it's really looking for density anomalies. So by placing the detector alongside the pyramid and within passageways within the pyramid, it was possible to identify a potential void, unknown void, previously unknown void, which transpired to be another chamber. So it's those same principles.
Of course, we're a geotechnical podcast, but a lot of this technology can be used in structures as well. How much of your work there at Central Alliance is structural rather than geotechnical?
We do some structural work. There's usually a crossover somewhere. So we do structural investigations, hence the sort of hidden shaft work in tunnels. We're also looking at the possibility of using muon tomography to look for voids within structures. So again, the older viaducts on network rail infrastructure do include construction voids, so it's important to understand those voids and their condition. Similarly, in perhaps more recently constructed structures, there are hidden critical elements. So, for example, degradation of rebar and things like that within concrete structures. Obviously, that's finer resolution. So, as the technology advances, we have a pathway moving from the larger features towards these smaller scale features as the detectors develop and become more advanced. But the second sort of series of detectors that have been manufactured and designed and built by the university team and Geoptic are able to provide much higher resolution. So we now effectively providing images like an X-ray. So we can see, for example, this diameter circular shaft in the case of hidden shaft investigations. And the technique is very similar to X-raying. The source in our case is naturally occurring cosmic ray muons rather than an X-ray machine. The subject matter is the overburden that we're looking at, whereas, within an X-ray, it's the body, the human body. And the detector itself is essentially the X-ray film, if you like. So it's very similar principles.
So I can understand why the Coal Authority would use the technology. But you mentioned Network Rail were your client on a scheme. Was that just because they were going to create a structure above a potential voided area? Or what was the application?
Yeah, so the application for Network Rail is the hidden shafts, so these hidden construction shafts, which are traditionally investigated by intrusive techniques, so drilling either from above down looking for the shafts or generally within the tunnel, drilling up into the crown of the tunnel through the lining to identify soft spots, essentially, where these hidden shafts may be located. So obviously any non-intrusive technique has a lot of advantages in terms of safety. We can place the detector at ground level and just move it through the tunnel. So it's very straightforward in terms of the operational aspects. And part of the trials were to discover really whether it was feasible to do this within the constraints of a railway possession. On a Saturday night, for example, where you've got limited working time. And the proof of concept trials, showed that that was feasible. So, but yes, the Coal Authority and in terms of mine workings, that's another application. And the university team and Geoptic are now developing down the hole detectors. So for use down bore holes as well as in open mine workings.
Yeah. And the Network Rail, they've also appointed you for using neutron soil moisture sensors, another term that's new to me. What was the application for those? And is it just a development of the muon, or is that something completely different?
Yeah, similar principles. It's utilizing cosmic rays again. So in this case, using it to evaluate soil moisture. So hydrogens in water absorb neutrons. So it's there's an inverse correlation between neutron counts in the detector and local volumetric water content. So we've got a detector as part of a trial for Network Rail in northwest Scotland, which is looking at a 200 metre radius, and it's essentially detecting neutrons. So the lower the neutron count, the higher the soil moisture. So a big part of our work currently and going forwards is assessing asset resilience to climate change. So by understanding soil moisture, correlating that to weather, understanding surface runoff, you know, is key to establishing how resilient assets are and whether any remedial works need to be undertaken or further inspections, etc. So that's part of a larger trial where we're using a remote sensing technique to map soil moisture. So that's using satellite synthetic aperture radar technique. So the soil moisture sensor is being used to calibrate that data as well.
Okay. So you wouldn't have the challenges of needing to have a sensor for in the ground for this one. This is something you could do all from surface level, is it?
That's right, yeah. So, our partner company on that project, Astera, which is an Israeli satellite technology company, developed this technique. That actually, the founder of the company carried out academic projects in the search for water on other planets, for the search for life. So the principles of the technology are adapted from those studies, initially used and developed by Astera to map for leak detection for water companies. So pinpointing or identifying an area where there is a potential leak by processing L-band synthetic aperture radar, satellite images. We've worked with Astera to slightly adapt that to map soil moisture. So essentially provide a heat map of soil moisture with a view to using that for geotechnical and drainage applications.
And it did amuse me when we were just looping back to the beginning, actually, doing this investigation to find something that we don't know is there. How do you get to that point of saying, right, there's something I'm not sure about in the ground? Presumably, it's really all about the desk study. The importance of a good desk study is going to lead you to those decisions, George.
Yeah, it's really around designing how you gather the information that you need, tailored for the particular project that you've got. So the desk study is really important in that process because that's where you establish the baseline of what's currently known. So you have it's a brownfield site that there's a construction project planned for. There's a certain amount of things that you therefore know at the start about that land, previous studies that might have taken place, previous sampling that might have happened. But then for your purposes, you might need some additional detail in some areas or to better understand some of the ground-related risks in other areas. And you use that requirement for information to design the information that you gather. And as Richard said, there's a real interplay then with geophysical techniques being part of the toolbox that you would use to gather that information to therefore minimise your ongoing risk of unforeseen ground conditions. And quite often it is a combination of intrusives and geophysics, which gives you that best balance. You know, I tend to say that a borehole or an excavation gives you an enormous amount of really detailed information, but only about that bit that you've dug up. So you then have to assume that that is representative of at least a certain amount of the rest of the site that you're seeking to develop. And that may or may not be a good assumption, depending on how variable the ground might be, how complex the geology is, what the history of it is. Whereas geophysics tells you one aspect of the physical parameter, be it density or elastic properties or electrical properties, but you can learn something about everything. So the combination of a little bit about everything and then everything about a little bit gives you actually the best view of the whole site, and that gives you usually the sweet spot of minimising risk.
Right. And how big is the market for geophysics in the country? I've got no idea really how it compares in size to sort of traditional techniques or to, well, even to the piling industry for that matter. And where do you really see the growth areas? We've mentioned a few different techniques today, but I've got no idea on the proportion that currently makes up and how they might grow over time. Is there any sort of common views on that topic?
I guess the most common technique and the most common geophysical approach that's used in the marketplace is for mapping buried surfaces, which relies heavily on ground penetrating radar as the principal technique to do that, and that's quite a, you know, that's quite a large part of the sort of survey and ground investigation industry across the UK and globally. In terms of areas where things are going to develop, I think as these new sensor technologies become commercially realistic, as they prove themselves in terms of the technology, then they will be increasingly adopted. I think there's still a lot of opportunity to use geophysics and sensing as part of an integrated approach to sites. And I think the bigger and higher risk a site is, the more geophysics is adopted as an integral part to the early information gathering. But I think there's a lot of scope for it to be used more often in other sites. I would say that, wouldn't I? But I think it genuinely is the case. And part of that is it being accessible as a thing to engage with, and the ability to get good advice, which was part of the idea behind my flowchart, is to give people a few questions they could answer for themselves to see whether they then should then go and ask someone like me or Richard for some more detailed advice for their particular project.
Well, I do think that we will see more of this sort of technology. As usual, I'm going to make an analogy with what I see within the piling sector and the ground investigations that I see. About, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, I would never see a damage impact assessment report as part of the ground investigation and part of our pile design process. And now, certainly any job with a basement in London next to a party wall, you will see that is absolutely commonplace. And I do wonder, as we start to learn more about these techniques, maybe as more companies adopt them and perhaps the costs start to come down, clients will start looking for it. Richard mentioned the impact of climate change and asset managers using this technology to manage the change in ground conditions. And it seems like an obvious application there. We've talked on this podcast a number of times about slope failures due to climate change, and really I think it's such a high risk area. In fact, it's remiss of me, I meant to bring up a case study that Richard you got involved with on the Harbury project, not far from where I was born in Leamington Spa, so it's just down the road from there. Because that was quite a prominent failure in the last few years, the slope failure there on the cutting, and just interested to learn a bit more about that scheme and what sort of technologies that you were using on that site.
Yeah, our involvement in that was largely ground investigation and survey work. So we carried out some of the drilling to get the ground investigation data required for the remedial works design. And then we carried out some surveying using a drone, as well as conventional surveying for topographic information and photogrammetry. And then we got involved in some dewatering works for that as well. But it was largely gathering data to inform the design team on the remedial works design.
Okay. And that's now stabilised it, is it, with the dewatering?
Yes, that's been remediated, all stabilised. Yeah, the principal contractor, Jay Murphy and Sons, yeah, completed that some time ago and have been working on similar projects in the same area since then as well.
Well, I suppose that really is the implication of, you know, we do this investigation, but we're doing it for a purpose, and the purpose in that case was to help develop a solution that would stabilise the ground, and yes, it is likely to result in more construction activity, but of course the downside of not investigating these things is that you could end up with a catastrophic failure and in some cases, unfortunately, fatalities. So Richard and George, thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have any suggestions for guests or topics, then please do get in touch. Bye-bye.